KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of MAMI, an art exhibit at Yale Union in Portland. MAMI is a group show that considers the mystery and chaos of motherhood, and in reaction to the sentimentality and laments the culturally constructed binary of, quote, family versus career, while acknowledging the persistence of that obstacle in the lives of artists. Again, that's MAMI, showing Thursday through Sunday, 3 to 6 p.m. until December 20th at Yale Union, located at 800 Southeast 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month is the amazing Nina Simone, showing Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. Nina Simone was one of America's true musical geniuses. With her unique signature mix of layering folk, gospel, classical, pop, and African music, along with a revolutionary vision of Black freedom, pride, and defiance. Again, that's the amazing and revolutionary Miss Nina Simone, showing as part of the We Real Cool film series on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this November 2nd Monday. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. Today on the Old Mole, we open the show with Bill Resnick interviewing Rebecca Gordon on the negotiations, including Russia and Iran, to find a path towards stopping the killing in Syria. Will this be a model for reconstructing the Middle East? Rebecca Gordon teaches in the philosophy department at University of San Francisco. Her new book, American Nuremberg, The Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes, comes out from Hot Books in March 2016. Tom Becker shares an article by Gary Leach entitled The Elephant in the Room, Capitalism and Sustainable Development. Have we utterly failed to face the reality of what sustainability means, thereby preventing any meaningful effort to change? The Left and the Law, with Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken, talk about the growing movement for prison reform and why conservatives are joining progressives in calling for an end to mass incarceration, long sentences, and the extensive use of solitary confinement. Jan and Mike talk about some of the challenges in separating the rhetoric from the real reforms and some of the dilemmas for activists around prison politics. I will be joined by Bill Resnick, closing today's show, with a look at the Bernie Sanders phenomena. In addition, we question the conclusions drawn by Emma Caterin in her truthout.org op-ed, Is Bernie Sanders Dangerous to Socialism? I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we turn to Bill Resnick and Rebecca Gordon.
Hi, Rebecca Gordon. Welcome to KBOO. It's a pleasure to be here.
Rebecca Gordon teaches at the University of San Francisco in San Francisco. Her most recent book, Managing Torture, the book about to be published is American Nuremberg, U.S. War Crimes and the So-Called War on Terror. Rebecca Gordon, Syria was one of the torture sites for the U.S. It was, in fact, a great favorite of the U.S. for a while. Tell us about Syria. How did it become a pariah state for the U.S.? And then tell us about the war going on there now, the horrible war, and the peace talks that happened on Friday.
All right. Well, let's start with the U.S. relationship with Syria, which for many years has been ambivalent, shall we say. So on the one hand, Syria was long on the State Department's list of state sponsors of terror and was considered to have a terrible human rights record. On the other hand, that made it extremely valuable to the United States when they wanted to have a place to send people to be tortured and didn't want anyone in the United States to know about it. The most famous case in the so-called War on Terror was the case of a man named Maher Arar, who's a Canadian citizen and a computer scientist who was returning home from a vacation in Tunisia. He happened to fly through JFK International Airport in New York City on his way home to Canada shortly after the beginning of the so-called War on Terror. So we're talking 2001, 2002. The FBI stopped him in New York, and rather than letting him continue home to Canada, they shipped him to Syria, where he was held for 10 months in an underground, windowless, airless cell, where he was beaten to the point where he still limps. And it was only after the Canadian government interceded that he was finally allowed to return to Canada. Interestingly, the Canadian government paid him recompense for the terrible trauma that he went through as the result of a suit. But in the United States, the courts have refused to allow him to sue because the executive branch of the government has argued that there are national security interests in not allowing him to sue in U.S. courts for what the United States did to him. So clearly the U.S. was cooperating with the government of Hafez al-Assad and now with his son Bashar al-Assad in Syria. At the same time, as I say, the public face of the U.S. was that we consider Syria a dangerous place. And in fact, there had been plans going back to the early 1990s among neoconservatives in the U.S. to topple the government of Syria. So back in 1992, Paul Wolfowitz and a number of other neocons wrote a paper for the Israeli government, which was called A Clean Break. And in it, they proposed that Israel should make a clean break with their existing military strategy and that they should begin by toppling Saddam Hussein in Iraq and then follow that up using that as a means to achieve their larger goal, which was to topple the Assad government in Syria, and that way be able to remake the entire Middle East on a model that better suited Israeli interests. Now, the government in Israel at the time was the first government of Benjamin Netanyahu, and they rejected this paper on the grounds that it also contained a suggestion that Israel should make a clean break with its dependence on the United States for military aid, which they were not prepared to do. So that was in 92. In 96, the same plan was presented to the Clinton administration. They chose not to follow it. However, we come up to 2001, and the terrible attacks on the World Trade Center in the United States. And now we have in the government Dick Cheney and his cronies, many of whom include Paul Wolfowitz and other people who wrote this original paper. Now they actually have an opportunity to put their plan in action, which begins by toppling Saddam Hussein. As we have seen, the United States is a whole lot better at throwing dictators out than it is at figuring out what to do next. And that was certainly the case in Iraq. We've seen the horrible results in Libya. And in Syria, the United States hasn't even managed to do the first step, which is to remove the government of Bashar al-Assad.
Rebecca Gordon, they're good at throwing some dictators out there. I think they're even better at creating new dictatorships. At least they were.
Yeah, and that's what we see in Egypt, for example.
Right now, yes.
Where the Arab Spring managed, in fact, to get rid of the government of Mubarak. They had an elected government that was majority led by the Muslim Brotherhood, which had long been an outlawed force. And it's true that the Muslim Brotherhood's rule was not particularly popular, and people grew restive and came back out into the streets. And at this point, the Egyptian army, I would imagine with a wink and a nod from the United States, decided to step in. They threw out the Muslim Brotherhood, once again outlawed them, and put in place El-Sisi, who is the head of the army and is now the head of the Egyptian government. And the U.S. has happily resumed arming Egypt and the Egyptian military. Egypt, as you know, is second only to Israel as the country that receives the largest amount of military aid from the United States.
Rebecca, how did though Syria spiral out of control? The U.S. would love to, and Israel, in fact, had fairly good relations with Assad, except for the fact that he supported the Lebanese Hezbollah. But the Golan Heights border was very quiet, and there was really no challenge, and they were sort of working together in many ways. What happened in Syria that made it this whirlpool drawing in now the Russians and the Iranians
and Turkey?
And then one of the sort of determining factors now in the horror of Syria and of the peace talks, the ISIS group, that is sort of independent, sort of once al-Qaeda affiliated, a group wanting to return to, in fact, there's not a return to any form of Islamism. Yeah. It's really their own crackpot vision of Islamic misogyny and purity of a weird and bizarre sort. This ISIS group has now a large base in Syria, in fact, even running some of the oil industry and profiting from it and getting huge amounts of money from Saudi Arabia, who seem to be playing the double game as they always have. How did Syria go out of control?
Well, okay, so we have to start with the fact that Syria was a quite well-controlled police state under Assad, and that it was a country that was, you know, really under fairly repressive rule with torture and extrajudicial murder for people who oppose the regime, and a fairly well-run state that worked for most people a lot of the time. However, there clearly underneath was growing objection. And when people saw what happened in Tunisia, when they saw what happened in Egypt, when they saw the uprisings that were spreading around the Arab world in the Arab Spring, people started coming out on the streets in Syria as well, demanding an end to the Assad regime.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Rebecca Gordon, who's a scholar, teaches at the University of San Francisco, is writing on torture and her book coming up, America Nuremberg, why there's a whole lot of U.S. elites who really should be prosecuted. She makes the case for that. Rebecca Gordon, we were talking about Syria and rising expectations and desires for democracy and security. They have very weird views of the West, and they see the West as rich and democratic, when in fact the West is rich and poor and democratic only in some forms, but really not in function and reality. But that's another matter, this idealized vision of the West. But they really wanted something else, the Arab masses. And then food prices began spiking, so that was the Arab Spring.
Yes, and there is a connection between climate change and the rising prices of commodities, and it affects not only the greater Middle East but also North Africa. And yeah, this is definitely a part of the problem. The other things that are going on is that there were forces that were supported by U.S. allies, i.e. the United Arab Emirates and much more so Saudi Arabia within Syria, which are essentially or were al-Qaeda affiliates like the al-Nusra Front. And then, as you pointed out before, we have the rise of Islamic State or Daesh, and which means the state. And this is something that has definitely had outside support, but as you also pointed out, ISIS has managed to take control of some of the oil fields in Syria, and it's very interesting that among their customers for the actual oil is the Assad government, which is fighting against them because Assad needs the oil. So the whole thing is extremely complex, and one of the things that I want to point out is that caught up in the middle of this are millions and millions of people who are not really actually part of the fighting at all, who are civilians who are not involved either in the armed resistance to Assad, in the al-Nusra Front, in any of the other organizations that are fighting, and it's a multi-sided war there. But they are simply people who have been driven out of their homes by war. So Syria has a population of 22 million. Of that, somewhere between 11 and 12 million, according to the United Nations, have had to leave their homes. So that is over half the population. Can you imagine if every other person in the United States had had to leave the place where they live, give up everything that they owned, and travel with what they can carry on their backs to try to find safety? Of those 12 million who've had to leave their homes because of the war, over 5 million of them are actually now outside of Syria, which has had a tremendously destabilizing effect on countries such as Lebanon, such as Turkey, Jordan, Iraq. When I was in Syria in 2006, it was to meet with Iraqi refugees who had fled the war the U.S. started in Iraq to Syria. Now Iraq has received almost a million Syrian refugees who are fleeing the war over there. So by going into Iraq in 2003, the United States has essentially touched off a conflagration whose end is really not yet in sight. So I do want to inject one voice of hope in here, which is that yesterday, on Friday, 17 different countries convened in Vienna in order to try to talk about just the very beginnings of finding an end to this war, which looks as though, if there isn't any kind of intervention, is going to go on for years. So among the groups, among the countries that met were, of course, the United States, Russia, which has recently entered the war on the side of the Assad regime, Iran, and this is the great achievement, that Iran was actually allowed to come in and participate in these talks. And this was as the result, in part, of intervention by the United States and Secretary of State John Kerry. So this marks a real change, a sea change in the U.S. relationship with Iran since the nuclear agreements of last summer. It's very important that Iran be involved because, as you point out, they are in fact arming some portions of the groups that are fighting in Syria, including Assad. So Iran, France was there, Turkey was there, which is very important because a big chunk of Turkey's southern border is the northern border of Syria, and that is the region where there are Kurdish people living in Syria and also on the other side of the border in Turkey. And you may remember that there is a long-running conflict within Turkey between ethnic Turks and ethnic Kurds, and between the Turkish, central Turkish government and various factions or various portions of the Kurdish population, including the party that's called the PKK. And so Turkey is also deeply concerned and deeply involved, and they've also received over a million refugees coming north out of Syria.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Rebecca Gordon, who's a scholar, teaches at the University of San Francisco, is writing on torture and her book coming up, America Nuremberg, why there's a whole lot of U.S. elites who really should be prosecuted. She makes the case for that, like Dick Cheney and others. Not inconceivable, incidentally. Henry Kissinger has spent a good deal of his later life avoiding war crime trials. It's actually a threat for some of those men.
Absolutely. Bush was going to go to Switzerland and decided against it because yes, they actually do try people over there.
Yeah. Let's conclude real quickly because the peace talks actually ended on somewhat positively. There are so many interests and it's not clear that there'll be any peace. And even any peace will not solve the problems of Syria and they will fester. But it's better than this. What's happening is a sort of a slow genocide.
Four things that came out of the peace talks. So the first one was that they agreed, these 17 countries that were meeting, to invite the UN to convene Syria's government and the opposition to start a new political process. So that's, the UN has actually been asked to bring the government and the opposition, the fighting forces, together in peace talks. A new constitution and UN-backed elections. have been agreed to, although when is not quite clear. But it would also include people who are living, who are in the diaspora, who are outside Syria now. Improved access to humanitarian aid for Syrians inside and outside the country, and working with the UN to explore modalities for an implementation of a nationwide ceasefire. And actually, this in some ways is the most important. It's the most urgent, that if we could actually achieve a nationwide ceasefire, then it would be possible to hold these other talks.
On the other hand, there's the ISIS group that's not part of this at all, is not being invited. And the wars are going to continue, I guess. They now have a common enemy. All of the warring factions, not all of the, some of the warring factions have a common enemy, which is the ISIS group.
Right, but a common enemy is not necessarily the same thing as a peace agreement.
No. This is going to go on for a while. Keep up your observations and analysis of Syria. We'll talk to you again, Rebecca Gordon. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
You're very welcome.
Thanks to Bill and Rebecca Gordon. Later in our program, in the second half, we'll hear from the Left and the Law with Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken talking about the growing movement for prison reform. We'll also hear from myself, your host, Denise Morris, and Bill Resnick about the Bernie Sanders phenomena, and we'll be responding to an article by Emma Caterin on truthout.org, Is Bernie Sanders Dangerous to Socialism? This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.FM, 90.7 FM. We're going now to Tom Becker. He shares an article by Gary Leach. Tom?
Good morning. The imperative to create sustainable economies on a worldwide basis is mandatory if the Earth is to have a long-term future. But the sort of massive changes required to achieve this goal are seldom confronted, undermining all efforts at its attainment. Today I'm reading excerpts from an article by Gary Leach entitled The Elephant in the Room, Capitalism and Sustainable Development. The term sustainable has been used by so many people in so many different contexts that it has lost much of its meaning. It has become a buzzword in political, economic, and development circles. But it's not the excessive use of the word that has ultimately rendered it largely meaningless, but the fact that too many efforts to achieve sustainable development do not seriously attempt to actually achieve sustainable development. It is too often suggested that we can simply incorporate more environmentally friendly practices into our daily lives, while only tinkering with our consumption habits in order to achieve sustainability. But this is simply not true. Each of us living in wealthy nations must massively, and I mean massively, reduce our levels of material consumption if we are to achieve a sustainable ecological footprint. And this reality is the elephant that is too often ignored in discussions about sustainable development. The belief that we can achieve sustainable development in wealthy nations such as the United States and Canada without dramatically diminishing our levels of material comfort is a form of denial that suggests we can have our cake and eat it too. Capitalism requires a constantly expanding production and consumption of goods, which can only be achieved through the increased exploitation of the planet's natural resources at an unsustainable rate. Because of this reality, sustainable development cannot be achieved without a dramatic reduction in the levels of production and consumption, which directly contradicts the growth logic that drives capitalism. While achieving such extensive reductions would indeed be challenging, they are possible. The United Nations noted that when the UN Human Development Index is combined with per capita ecological footprint of 182 nations, only one country has a genuinely sustainable economy. That country is Cuba. In other words, Cuba is the only country in the world that has met the basic needs, food, housing, health, and education, of all its citizens in an ecologically sustainable manner. The realities of wealthy nations, high human development and high ecological footprint, and poor nations, low human development and low ecological footprint, are directly linked. Because we have only one planet, Earth, the sustainable high per capita ecological footprints of wealthy nations such as the United States and Canada are achieved by North Americans consuming other people's share of the planet's resources. As a result, the resources of poor countries are exploited, not for the benefit of local populations, but to satiate the consumption appetites of wealthy nations. Since we and the wealthy nations of the global north can only sustain our materialistically comfortable lifestyles by consuming other people's share of the planet's resources, we condemn those people to a shortened life of poverty and misery. In fact, more than 10 million people die needlessly each year from hunger, as well as from preventable and treatable diseases, under a global capitalist system that constitutes structural genocide. The gross inequalities inherent in capitalism are also a major cause of wars, mass migration, refugees, human trafficking, and escalating criminal violence throughout much of the global south. Our unsustainable lifestyle is not only causing massive human suffering and death for millions around the world today, it is destroying the planet for future generations. In order to achieve sustainable development for everyone on Earth and to ensure the survival of future generations, we and the wealthy nations must reduce our capita ecological footprint to 1.7 global hectares. Given that the current per capita ecological footprint in the United States is 6.8 global hectares, there is no way that such a transformation can be achieved by simply encouraging people to switch to hybrid cars and organic vegetables. We require a much more comprehensive shift in our consumption habits. And since Cuba is the only nation in the world that has achieved sustainable development, it makes sense to look at that country for some pointers. The disintegration of the Soviet Union in 1991 meant that Cuba lost its principal trading partner and supplier of oil. In order to survive, Cuba undertook a dramatic transformation of its economy during the 1990s that resulted in achieving sustainable development. The country has continued to prioritize the use of its lunar resources to ensure that the basic needs of its entire population are met with regard to food, housing, health care, and education. It's also shifted from large-scale industrial agriculture to smaller organic farming. More than 85% of Cuba's agricultural production is now organic, and there is no factory farming of animals, two things that dramatically diminish its carbon footprint. There are also a few privately owned vehicles in Cuba, and the overwhelming majority of the population uses public transportation, thereby further reducing the country's carbon footprint. Finally, the country's low consumption level of goods means that items such as vehicles, furniture, clothing, shoes, and appliances are repaired and reused in order to extend their lifespans, rather than simply being discarded and replaced with new items, as occurs in our disposable consumer culture. The redefining of socialism in Cuba has also revitalized community-based economic development through a combination of worker-owned cooperatives, small private enterprises, and state-owned businesses. So while most Cubans do not enjoy the relatively luxurious materialistic lifestyles of people in the wealthy nations, they're immune to the extreme poverty, misery, and death that plague much of the global south under capitalism's structural genocide. Ultimately, if we are serious about achieving sustainable development, we have to address the elephant in the room, the fact that we must dramatically diminish our levels of material consumption, which contravenes the very logic that drives the capitalist system. A failure to implement such systematic changes means that all well-intentioned efforts to achieve sustainability will ultimately fail. So unless we acknowledge that global inequality and ecological destructiveness inherent in the capitalist system, our efforts to achieve sustainable development will amount to little more than window dressing. Capitalism requires corporations to unsustainably exploit the planet's resources in order to constantly increase production and maximize profits. It also requires us to constantly consume the increasing quantities of goods produced. The inevitable outcome is structural genocide and ecological Armageddon. It's time we recognize that less is more for everyone, but especially for our children and grandchildren. That was an article entitled The Elephant in the Room, Capitalism and Sustainable Development by Gary Leach. Gary Leach is an independent journalist and author of numerous books, including Capitalism, A Structural Genocide. He is also a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Cape Breton University in Canada. The complete article is on the Counterpunch webpage and can be found by searching for Elephant in the Room, Capitalism.
That is Blundertown by The Birthday Party. Next up, we've got The Left and the Law with Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken. They're going to talk about the growing movement for prison reform. Jan?
Well, news this weekend heralded a landmark advance in prison reform with the release of over 6,000 people from federal prisons, primarily incarcerated on drug charges. About a third of them are foreign citizens who will be deported, a less talked about element of this acclaimed victory. Mike, many commentators note the emerging so-called consensus on the need for prison reform and reducing the staggering size of our prison population and length of sentences. What is there to celebrate in this release of prisoners from federal correction facilities this weekend?
Well, it's always good when our excessive and draconian punishments are reduced and people are released from prison. But if every single person convicted of a drug crime were released from prison tomorrow, it would barely make a dent in the problem. What we're just beginning to think about is the fact that the staggering size of our problem of incarceration cannot be addressed until we think about the whole notion of what is a proper punishment for murder, for burglary, for sex crimes, because these are the crimes of which most people have been convicted.
Well, let's talk about that more in a moment. But first, getting back to federal prisons, the data on federal prisons suggests that a very high percentage, depending on what data you look at, maybe 40-50%, are there on drug charges. Why are there so many people on drug charges in federal prisons, and what's the difference between federal and state prisons?
Well, most people are locked up in state prison, 86% as of last year. Federal law enforcement agencies are really involved with drug crimes because they can be. You know, there's like a opportunistic ability of federal law enforcement agencies to do drug crimes because during the mania, when drug crimes were seen as the most important problem confronting us, federal agencies were all given jurisdiction over what would have previously been state crimes. So there's a significant percentage of people in federal prison for drug crimes, but the number in state prison is very small, like 5 or 6%.
There's also a broader appeal and unity behind the and critiques of the war on drugs. And of course, a lot of people take recreational drugs in this country. And so most sympathies are toward marijuana, which we see in all of the advances around legalization of marijuana. So kind of the portrait of this sympathetic prisoner is the kid smoking pot who gets caught and then put in prison, and the irrationality and absurdity of that, because you have to have some degree of moral authority for laws to be upheld in terms of how much they reflect actual norms. So the unifying rhetoric is that we must release low-level drug offenders and reserve prisons for violent offenders. What's wrong with that storyline?
Well, first, the rise in imprisonment in the United States over the last 40 years is hard to understate. We had 50 years from the 20s through the 70s of having about 100 per 100,000 people locked up in prison. That's the same as the rest of the world. But beginning in the 1970s, we went from having 300,000 people in state prison to over 1.5 million. Our average incarceration rate went from 100 to 500 per 100,000. It's a boom that's unprecedented anywhere else in the world.
Is that also taking into account the likelihood of people, and particularly minorities, of serving some time in the criminal justice system during their lives, and the traumatic disruptions that follow? I mean, there are different ways of aggregating these data, and how many in prison at a given time versus how many spend some time in a jail or prison over the course of their lifetime?
Well, the real problem is prosecutorial discretion. prosecutors will do whatever they think will further their careers. If they have an option to charge a crime as a felony or a misdemeanor, which they usually do, if charging a felony will further their career, that's what they'll do. And we have gradually become inured to the idea that like 10 years, 15 years for a burglary is appropriate. In the 70s, a 10-year sentence was considered average, if not kind of severe, for a first-degree murder. Now there are 25 years minimum terms for first-degree murder. Our sentence lengths and our sense of what is appropriate as punishment have expanded terrifically. Our sense of what is a crime has expanded terrifically. With the use of words like predators and trafficking, sex crimes have not only become far more severely punished, but what constitutes a sex crime has also expanded greatly.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, like, pimping used to be a relatively minor crime. Now it's called trafficking, and people do 10 to 20 years in prison for it.
So this is an area, and we'll be returning to this next month, the whole area of the expansion of the category of sex offenders. But the notion of violence in the criminal justice system, which seems like a kind of straightforward concept for everyday people, the someone who is an unpredictable threat to others and the well-being of others, and that the role of jails and prisons is to protect people from arbitrary threats to their lives. You're saying in the legal system, this is a much more complicated and socially constructed category, what constitutes a violent offender.
And what constitutes a threat? If a person has one explosive moment, are they likely to repeat it? There's lots of data, for example, that murderers have a lower recidivism rate than the average male between 14 and 44. Facts like this have to become important. We cannot cut by 50% the prison rate, which is what people want to do, without looking at what we consider to be punitive and what we consider to be threatening, and really reexamining our whole sense of an appropriate response to criminal behavior.
There's, getting back to prosecutors, what then, given that prosecutors are protected from legislative interventions and are quite protected politically, maybe you could say a little bit more about the life of a prosecutor and the thinking of a prosecutor, because I think many people think about juries and judges and legislatures kind of driving the criminal justice system. But prosecutors, that's another world within the criminal justice system.
It's an impenetrable world, too. They have discretion to do whatever they feel is right. And what they'll do is, as I said before, what will further their career. And so in a way, they reflect all of us in that their political success, not only in terms of advancing within the world of crime and punishment, but on to become governors, to become senators, to become legislators. If they're rewarded by harsh punishments, by always choosing the more punitive way, that's what they'll do.
And they position themselves often in their rhetoric, as defenders of the safety of people.
Exactly.
Guardians of virtue and safety, and defending against vice.
Well, if you look at legislatures can be important, but only in a rounding sense. I mean, the basic advance, if we're going to really lower significantly the prison population to get it back to its historical norm, will be political pressure on prosecutors. It will have to go squarely there, and that's really the only way to reach them. They cannot be reached in any other way, because the law gives them such basic discretion. That's why we have a racist system, because, you know, black people from the age of 3, when they're being disciplined in nursery school, if it's a completely discretionary system, they will always be the ones who will be isolated, who will be punished, who will be targeted. And there's no way to reach that. Efforts to reach that, for example, in jury selection, are almost impossible to succeed, even when they've got judicial decisions on the legitimate reasons for discharging a person from a jury. They'll find ways to get rid of all black people from a jury.
You've also mentioned the role of the death penalty in all of this, and plea bargaining.
Well, the death penalty, so long as that exists, one of the many problems with it is that it makes a sentence like life without possibility of parole seem, well, lightweight. Being locked up for the rest of your life in a room the size of a ping pong table is a bargain if you've been charged with death.
Yeah, there's something that is so obscene, but it does become part of the even the progressive rhetoric around the death penalty, fighting for life without parole. Of course, then you can continue to fight. It is an important distinction in that life without parole means that there is still some way in which you can benefit from real reform.
Well, it's a qualitatively different and a better sentence than a death sentence, certainly. But it's a horrible sentence. It's a demeaning, it's a discouraging, and it cannot really be addressed until we get rid of the death penalty. Then I think it's full, all the problems will emerge with such a sentence. And we, like the, you can chart in any state legislature in Oregon, California, New York from the 70s how a burglary case has gone from the average length of time served by a burglar has gone from 2.5 years to 3.5 years to 4.5 years to 5.5 years. It goes up and up along with every other felony crime. Do we really need to do that? The fact is the crime rate has gone down steadily since 1991. For 25 years, we've had a steadily dropping crime rate as our population has aged.
And there's an opportunism in the prison industries to have to continue, like I suppose many organizations, to justify their existence in the name of the public good.
That's what they do. They lobby every year for a lengthening of every sentence. They've got it down to a political science, where they'll typically find the name of a victim of a particular kind of crime. One legislator will sponsor a bill doubling the sentence for that particular crime in the name of this person who will appear before the committee. And the next year, another committee member will have another crime with another victim, and they'll do the same thing.
Yeah, and in closing, let's talk about some groups that are taking this on in a broader sense. What do you think are, I mean, there are many organizations now that's, I guess, the hopeful side is how many organizations are not only focusing on police brutality, the direct physical confrontation with police in the streets, but the broader criminal justice system.
Well, there is a group called Cut 50. They have a website designed to cut the prison population by 50%, and they realize that talking about drug crimes and the drug war on drugs is just the beginning. We have to really think hard about all the other crimes and the nature of punishment before we can seriously reduce our prison population. Then the Marshall Project is relatively new, but they've become the go-to place for information about the criminal justice system.
Great website. TheMarshallProject.org. Check them out. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the release of prisoners from federal penitentiaries and the hope in hard times of prison reform.
Savior machine. They called it the prayer. Its answer was law. Its logic stopped war. Gave them food. How they adored till it cried in its boredom. Please don't.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. I am rejoined by Bill Resnick. We're going to talk a little bit about the Bernie phenomenon. Come across an article over the weekend by Emma Caterin. She's a self-described Marxist troublemaker and a student at the City University in New York. And her article is titled, Is Bernie Sanders Dangerous to Socialism? So I wanted to just kind of give folks a sense of what that article explores, and Bill and I are going to just talk a little bit about it and see what we can make of the Bernie Sanders campaign. So in Iowa, Bernie Sanders disclosed what democratic socialism means to him. He gives Social Security, Medicare, and the police as examples of socialist institutions. Quote, from the article, the last time I heard these institutions in the United States referred to as socialists was when they were being attacked by libertarians like Ron Paul and Ross Perot. And it appears that the independent turned Democrat from Vermont and unrepentant capitalists share the viewpoint that government institutions are inherently socialist. Empirically and historically incorrect, they endanger any hope for building socialism in the United States through a doublespeak of calling liberal institutions socialist. Social Democrats believe that the purpose of the state is to intervene in but not take over the capitalist economy in order to promote social justice. And we'll go on. Socialism is ownership by workers of the means of production or worker control of the economy. The different types of socialism are different proposals of how to accomplish these aims, from the transitional programs of Trotskyists and the autonomous collectives of the syndicalists. Bill, she also soundly and I think rightly critiques his calling the police a socialist institution. There's a good bit on that. I will let folks read the article there, and we'll move on to...
I think she overstates and misinterprets his line, but he does see public safety people as possibly servants rather than But
given his trouble with Black Lives Matters and the like, that's a dangerous waters to tread, would you say?
Yes, particularly when community policing can be so authoritarian. In fact, just setting up a community apparatus for suppressing people who militantly disagree. On the other and. I think that's right, though. In some ways, she's got it right, in that really we have to be talking about a different form of policing, of public safety, not of policing. There are things, you need people in society who can intervene when somebody really goes off badly, or there's a fire, or there's, you know, dangers of various kinds. There are people who have to be trained to be able to deal with it. But in fact, when you set up a professionalized, bureaucratized police force attached to the big corporate forms and the elites of politics, as happens in this country and in capitalism in general, then you get what we have is a occupying army, especially, of course, for the bottom 50%. That point should be made. I think Bernie was sort of whitewashing and going, that was the worst of his sort of social democratic. That's where he's a right-wing social democrat, as she points out. He's not really a socialist. I think we should start there and talk about the virtues of Bernie. He's got a lot of virtues. And he could be not just a danger to the left. That's the title of Ms. Caterin's article. It's a tremendous opportunity for the left. Bernie is really a force that... As you pointed out, right? But why don't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, every day I receive some email from some organization saying they have come out in support of Bernie. Labor unions, locals, all sorts of groups. The amount of money that he's been able to raise in short periods of time, the response has just been tremendous.
Yeah, and his critique of the elites of this country is very damning and very strong and vivid and has the mark of sincerity and touches people. And they get excited, in fact. Bernie has become a force in America. He even has, by calling himself a socialist, which it's not clear that he really is, nor is he the kind of socialist I think that we need to develop. That's another matter. But by calling himself a socialist, he has aroused this whole vision, discussion of what socialism. Can you imagine that? It's happening in the Washington Post. It's happening in the New York Times. It's happening on CNN and various other places. Well, is that
just KBOO and Democracy Now?
That isn't so dangerous from my point of view. It seems to me that's great. The question is how well those people who say Bernie socialism is quite limited. Mm-hmm. It may well be within the social democratic tradition, which is basically, as Roosevelt pointed out, his goal. I'm going to save capitalism. Damn those guys. Damn the capitalists. Despite them, I'm going to save their ass.
Right.
You can say that on the air, right?
We'll find out.
They're donkey. You can save their donkey.
I might have to dump you.
In any event, you know, Bernie is partly that, but he goes beyond that. And that makes he's not just a danger then. A lot of his policies, like on workers' co-ops and his energy policy, it anticipates a real democratization of the society, not just a humanizing of it to make workers a little happy to work in, basically an autocratic society in which they have no voice, nor are they allowed much dignity for most people.
Katherine, in her article, does point out that there's these are troubled waters that the left is stepping into, particularly with Bernie going from having been an independent and running as an independent in Vermont to running in the Democratic Party, which the left has always believed it was where left movements go to die, the Democratic Party. So this is one point of contention in how the left engages. She concludes her article by saying, the socialist of this country must cease pulling punches with Bernie Sanders, often held in the hope that his candidacy is an entryway to actual socialism. She does point to some work that's happening in Seattle with socialist alternatives as the kinds of movements we might build. Bill, you're always on board with building movements and that being the thing that we must do. Talk a little bit more about your sense of how the left engages here.
Yeah, well, in her article, she counterposes working in movements. She sees many of the movements as just social democratic and fitting people into the system. And then there's another set of movements that are somehow that have to be distant from any of the sort of liberal and liberal institutions. And I think that it seems to me that most movements now in the United States, since people really are dissatisfied and democratically inclined, they want a voice in the world. They aren't satisfied with being living in a society that's run basically by elites for elites, with strong police forces keeping people in control, as well as companies who can keep their workers in control by either firing or leaving the city or threatening to. I mean, there's tremendous power at the top, and people recognize it. So these movements for even just, let's say, for raising the minimum wage, well, that's just a social democratic movement, but it's a movement that really empowers people when they get there. And if those movements affiliate with other movements that have more radical aims, like city movements for empowering workers in a variety of ways, including, let's say, running the energy companies. I mean, she talks about workers' control, but it's really what we need is democracy throughout the whole society, not just control of industry. Mm-hmm. And that's in any event, all of those movements have real promise. And the question for the left is, does it move towards just dying in the Democratic Party, which they generally they do humanize capitalism, to be sure, but they lose their radical thrust of democracy. How can we keep those movements going in the direction that they are going, actually, towards, you know, real democratic functioning and envisioning a democratic society?
Can Bernie win? We have 1 minute Bernie to win,
really?
And then we're going to shift gears. Yeah, but in
right.
that minute... You know.
Yeah, that's really a good question because Bernie is not going to win, probably. And that makes, and then the question is, what happens to those Bernie's forces? Do they just get discouraged? Oh, we tried and he only got 40% or 30% of the vote. And look at how hard we tried and everything. And they get discouraged and, mm-hmm. you know, and decide to go into, I don't know, music videos.
Right. So I think they're all already
gambling.
In
music videos. Many, many things. There's yeah. so many things.
Back to the gadgets.
That you can put your life into. So that's the challenge to people in yeah. the movements who want to see a democratic, a really democratic society, is to keep that enthusiasm going, but within those movements. And Bernie really did, ignite something.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, the Mets came very close to winning the World Series over the weekend, but just because they lost some heartbreaking games does not mean they won't come back next
year for another season.
That's
right. And maybe they can improve their defense a little, although a good offense yeah. is a good defense.
This is really what we should be talking about, sports. The left, we have skeletons
in
our
really
closet.
We really ought to yeah. shift all of our yeah. attention into sports, like many people do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But their team doesn't win very often, you know. But you, Denise, yeah. know how to
it's
deal
huge.
With losing, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wait until next year. The bums.
All okay. right.
So, Bill, you have some announcements.
Yeah, I want to announce two city hearings being now back to the future and back to actual activism. Two city hearings being held this week, both on Wednesday, the first on climate change and stopping fossil fuel export, like coal export. The second on liberating Palestinians and ending the Israeli occupation. Both of those Wednesday hearings will feature lots of testimony and lots of ways to show support. The first one starts at 2:30 in the afternoon at City Hall before the City Council. It's on a proposed city policy. It was introduced and promoted by a big coalition of Portland groups, 350.org, the Sierra Club, Rising Tide, others. The policy would prohibit new projects that transport or store industrial quantities of coal, oil, gas in Portland. That's being hotly opposed by many business interests. The second hearing will be before the Portland Human Rights Commission meeting starting at 4 p.m., also again this Wednesday. It ends at 6, will be held right next door to City Hall in the City of Portland Building Auditorium. It's on the second floor, which is fairly big, but it's likely to fill early. The hearing is the Human Rights Commission passed a boycott, divest, sanctions resolution. There are various forces in the city who support sort of the Zionist project who are opposing that resolution and asking for a rehearing. There's also groups like Jewish Voice for Peace who really support that resolution and introduced it and fought for it. It's going to be a very hard-fought hearing. The people who are calling for to end the occupation will be there. So will the people who support the occupation. And the people who want to end it need support. So that's this Wednesday, a doubleheader, Denise.
A doubleheader
at 2:30 and 4.
It all does come back
yeah.
to sports. It will be a fight.
Yes.
Well, thanks, Bill, and I want to thank our listeners for joining us this morning. It's a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. I want to thank, of course, Bill Resnick and his guest earlier, Rebecca Gordon, Tom Becker, Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker, our engineer Patsy Kohlberg. I am your host, Denise Morris. Let me tell you what's going on with KBOO coming up at 10 o'clock. It's Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. 10:15, Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, her guest Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham. They'll talk about why Shell Oil is abandoning their plans to drill for oil in the Arctic. At 11, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. We'll hear about the new book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. That's co-authored by David R. Montgomery and Anne Bickley. At 11:30, Madness Radio with host Will Hall. Today's guest is Guardian columnist Mary O'Hara, author of the new book Austerity Bites, about the devastating impact of austerity on the mental health services industry and community. Thanks again for listening. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, this is John Shutt, host of Religion for Life. This week I speak with Val Webb, scientist and theologian from Australia, about her new book, Testing Tradition and Liberating Theology, Finding Your Own Voice.
What's contemporary theology about? To me, it's wonder. It's about wondering, both wondering at the wonder and wondering about the mystery.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.